Without any further delay then, we now ask for your undivided attention to the words of Brother David as he comes forward and speaks on our fourth studies together, the work of Elijah and the second Exodus. Brother David, please.
Brothers and sisters, Brother Matthew alluded to the 25th chapter of Leviticus, verse 9, where we read, "Then shalt thou cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, and the Day of Atonement shall ye make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. And ye shall hallow the 50th year, and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a jubilee unto you, and he shall return every man unto his possession, and he shall return every man unto his family." Brother Matthew demonstrated to us this morning the events preceding the smiting of the image, the invasion of Gog into the Middle East area, while Brother Philip outlined the succeeding events in the smiting of the image and its grinding to powder, resulting in the glorious fulfilment of Apocalypse chapter 11. "The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of Yahweh and of his anointed, when all their subject nations will be blessed in Abraham and his seed." Now, says Brother Thomas, in Eureka, "the judgments that are to accomplish all these results are those to be displayed in the days of the voice of the seventh angel when he shall sound. It is the conclusion of the premises laid by the sounding of the previous six. This seventh apocalyptic trumpet, in the seventh period of its sounding, brings out the events prefigured in the Mosaic trumpet of the Jubilee. It brings in its consummation the atonement, or covering over of the sins of Israel, liberty from their long previous bondage to the house of Esau, and return to their possessions in the Holy Land," which is his reference to Leviticus 25. "The assembling of the tribes is proclaimed, and their camps are marshalled for their journeying. The princes, the heads of the thousands of Israel, or the saints, gather together unto Christ, and Israel is saved from their enemies." You may wish to look at Numbers 10 in your own time at that as well, which we've been reading in the daily readings. This is our subject this evening, the work of Elijah, the assembling of the tribes. It is the antitypical assembling of the tribes, the marshalling of them for their journeys, as well as for war, which we will see in the proceedings this evening. And they are being prepared for this stone kingdom. Brother Philip took us through the elements of this stone kingdom. First, Christ and his saints. "I've trodden the winepress alone." That's the multitudinous Christ. "Having delivered the third from the latter-day Assyrian, the stone power will also incorporate, albeit an immortal element, this third of Judah." As Brother Philip pointed out, throughout the war on the beast, this stone kingdom proceeds through the earth, crushing and pulverizing all opposition in its path, particularly the beast, but indeed all human rulers. And during that same time, this is subsequent to the smiting of the image, during that same time, the 10 tribes will also be incorporated in this stone power, or this stone kingdom, as you might say, resulting in Christ, the saints, and the 12 tribes, the fulfillment of the promises to Abraham. And of course, Christianity, especially the mother of harlots herself, is entirely ignorant that Elijah even has a future work, let alone the nature of his work. They think that the statues in the land of Israel are more to reflect his past and his future ascension to heaven, or rather his past ascension to heaven, forever there to remain. We know that this is apostasy, and likewise, we may say with a degree of sadness, so do the Jews fail to understand it. They do indeed hope and pray for the return of Elijah, and they do realize he has a work with them. But they completely fail to comprehend the key elements of his work. It is not just to restore the kingdom to Israel, it is to enlighten them. And in fact, it was an excuse for the Jews in rejecting Messiah during his first advent. So what is the work of Elijah? Well, I have to disappoint you. I'm going to take a little while answering this question. Let's turn to Mark chapter 1 to begin with. Mark chapter 1. And we start at verse 1. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. As it is written in the prophets, "Behold, I send my messenger before thy face, which shall prepare thy way before thee. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make his paths straight." John did baptize in the wilderness and preach the baptism of repentance for the remission of sins. Now, there are two Old Testament prophecies referred to here. Isaiah chapter 40 verse 3 and Malachi chapter 3 verse 1. Isaiah chapter 40 says, "The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of Yahweh, make straight in the desert the highway for our Elohim." And Malachi chapter 3 verse 1, "Behold, I send my messenger, and he shall prepare thy way before me. And the Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in. Behold, he shall come, saith Yahweh Tzevaoth." So Mark then gives us to understand that John the Baptist would prepare the way for the appearance of the Lord Jesus Christ, and would therefore precede his appearance. And yet, Malachi 3 refers to a great and terrible day, if we read the whole context. And Isaiah chapter 40 to every valley being exalted. How then could this refer to John? We are all more than cognizant of the fact that in the days of Christ, none of this was achieved in the absolute sense. So how could this messenger referred to here refer to John? Again, let's turn back a few pages to Matthew chapter 11. Which will bring us closer to our answer. Matthew chapter 11 and verse 13. Or verse 12. "And from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence, and the violent take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. And if he will receive it, this is Elias," or Elijah, which was for to come. So Christ says that John is Elijah. We now have to ask the question, in what way is John Elijah? We already have a clue that we have John as a sort of incipient fulfillment of this work of Elijah. But in what sense is this? Let's have a look at Luke chapter 1 to answer our question. Luke chapter 1 and verse 15. "For he shall be great in the sight of the Lord," this is the angel to Zechariah, "and shall drink neither wine nor strong drink, and he shall be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb. And many of the children of Israel shall he turn to the Lord their God. And he shall go before him in the spirit and power of Elias, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord." We can see then, this was the preparation work of John. Brother Thomas says, "Appearances then of the messenger of the covenant to the nation are preceded by messengers sent by Yahweh to Israel. Messengers individually too, but officially and spiritually one. Compare the work of John with the history of Elijah. One power exhibited in both, the spirit of prophecy and a like authority in Israel. This," he says, "is the power." The word of the Lord, interestingly, came to both while sojourning by Jordan. And if we were to study the both, we would no doubt find a lot of similarities in the work of Elijah to in the days of Ahab and the work of John in the days of Herod. So this was the work of John in the power of Elias. And yet, as we read in John chapter 10, the gospel record of John chapter 10, that John did no miracle, whereas Elijah performed many. So the power that John had was the power of the word to convert the Jews from their Hellenistic ways in preparation for them to receive the Messiah. the last week of the 70 weeks of Daniel, as we know, was split equally between the work of John and the work of Christ. And Christ recognizes both the character and the work of John in Matthew chapter 11, verse 11. Among them, he says, that are born of women, there hath not risen a greater than John the Baptist. So John's identity with Elijah, then, is not wonder-working, as Brother Thomas says, because Christ's mission then was individually enlightening and converting, as well as covenant-confirming in his sacrifice, of course. The power of Elijah, however, will be prophesying and enlightening, and he also has a political mission. In other words, it will not be individually enlightening, but a national enlightening. Therefore, the messenger who will precede the future work of Christ will involve both the spirit power of enlightening in teaching, and also in miracles or wonder working, and this will have a very fatal effect on the nations, as we shall see. And so we might say that the scribes and Pharisees were right in one sense to look for the appearance of Elijah to precede the coming of the Messiah, but they were wrong to reject Christ just because the literal Elijah had not come. As the angel proclaimed to Zechariah, there would be one who would come in the power of Elijah, and this was John. So why, you might ask, have I carried out this lengthy comparison between John and Elijah before even investigating the work of Elijah in the second Exodus? Well, because I thought it necessary perhaps to drive home the importance of this work of Elijah. And plus, the work of John gives us some clues as to the nature of the work of Elijah, because we might feel like homing in on the work of Elijah in restoring the tribes of Israel, but as we are more than aware, to be fair, is more than just restoring the tribes. It's restoring them in faith and recognition of the Messiah. Just as the work of John was indispensable to the work of Christ, so will the work of Elijah be to him in his second manifestation at the great and terrible day of Yahweh. He has a work to perform in the midst of Israel before they are permitted to personally acquaint themselves with Messiah. So it's not just to deliver Israel from their enemies, he will have to enlighten them and, to use these words, prepare the way for Messiah. It's interesting, looking at the first Exodus, to see that the angel in the bush did not personally go down to Israel in Egypt. He sent Moses to bring them into the wilderness, where he met them through Moses as the representative of the invisible majesty. And so Elijah will be likewise sent by Christ, who is the fire-swept but never destroyed thorn bush. He will be sent to Israel to prepare them and bring them out to the great city figuratively called Egypt. Now it would be nice, would it not, to think that all Israel would need after the bloodshed of Armageddon and their sad and long history and persecution throughout all the nations is a call to come out from among them. But as Brother Thomas pointed out regarding Israel 430 years after the covenant confirmed to Abraham, they differed only from the Egyptians in being the oppressed instead of the oppressor. That is, they were children in whom was no faith. It is the same today, and it will be the same in the last days. And therefore, as with all elements of the truth, the work will be a work of time. Isaiah 8 verse 14 tells us, "He shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling and for a rock of offence to both the houses of Israel, for a gin and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many among them shall stumble and fall, and be broken, and be snared, and be taken." But he has already been a rock of offence to Judah. That process is not complete, but they rejected him 2,000 years ago, and they have suffered for it since. And obviously, as Brother Matthew and Brother Philip have enumerated, they are yet to suffer again when that latter-day Assyrian descends on the land as a whirlwind. So the cutting off of the two-thirds, then, will complete this purging process of the house of Judah. But he has not yet been a rock of offence to the ten tribes. As we know, they never returned to the land after the Assyrian captivity. And so the 10 tribes have never even witnessed Christ in their presence. He becomes a rock of offence to them during this work of Elijah. As Moses was sent to proclaim the gospel to Israel in Egypt, so Elijah will proclaim the gospel of the kingdom, the age that is about to come, the millennium. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 66, which is really a summary of much of the events subsequent to the return of Christ. Isaiah chapter 66, verse 15. For behold, Yahweh will come with fire, and with his chariots like a whirlwind, to render his anger with fury, and his rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire and by his sword will Yahweh plead with all flesh, and the slain of Yahweh shall be many. They that sanctify themselves and purify themselves in the gardens behind one tree in the midst, eating swine's flesh and the abomination and the mouse, shall be consumed together, saith Yahweh. For I know their works and their thoughts. It shall come that I will gather all nations and tongues, and they shall come and see my glory. And I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape of them unto the nations, to Tarshish, Pul, and Lud, that draw the bow to Tubal and Javan, to the isles afar off that have not heard my fame, neither have seen my glory. And they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles. And they shall bring all your brethren for an offering unto Yahweh, out of all nations, upon horses and in chariots, and in litters, and upon mules, and upon swift beasts, to my holy mountain Jerusalem, saith Yahweh, as the children of Israel bring an offering in a clean vessel into the house of Yahweh. Here then we are really beginning to get into our subject. Where will the nations be gathered to? In verse 18, Zechariah 14 verse 2 tells us, I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken. What next? Well, Brother Philip has already answered this. Then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those nations, as when he fought in the day of battle. The day of battle? In the day of battle, we read, there was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel, save the Hivites, for it was of Yahweh to harden their hearts, that he might destroy them utterly. And Zechariah chapter 10 says, mine anger was kindled against the shepherds, and I punished the goats. For Yahweh of earth hath visited his flock, the house of Judah, and hath made them as his goodly horse in the battle. This is the role of the 10 tribes, is it not? This is the role of Judah. But what about the 10 tribes? And this is our study. We'll do our best, I'll do my best, to try and fit in the role of the 10 tribes, the work of Elijah and the 10 tribes, in the way that this stone kingdom fills the whole earth. So chronologically in our address, the tents of Judah are already saved. And Brother Thomas says that in verse 19, I will set a sign among them, that this them refers to the 10 tribes. And he says, who is this sign or wonder that is set among them? Isaiah chapter 9 verse 6 gives us a clue. His name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, etc. And therefore we have Christ before us, especially the multitudinous Christ. Christ placed among the third with his saints, constituting this little stone power, only in the incipient stages of the world campaign. Thereafter they become a great mountain filling the whole earth. So chronologically then, this would be, if we were to assume that 50 years is the period from the return of Christ to the earth and to the complete establishment of the kingdom, this would be right at the start of the 40 years, 10 years after his return, but at 40 years before the beginning of the kingdom. Men from this third part of Judah are sent as ambassadors of Jesus to the nations, then we can see from verse 19. Now they're not as ambassadors who take up residence in the courts of kings of the earth, but like Moses and Aaron, who were ambassadors of Yahweh sent to Egypt to proclaim the fame of their king, their master, and the glory of his name, so will Judah, Elijah, and the remnant of Judah, or the men amongst Judah, be sent to be ambassadors. They will invite the aggregation of people, the people of Israel, into the wilderness to accept the rod of correction and be a living sacrifice to Yahweh. This is the Aeonian gospel. It achieves two things. It calls Israel, the 10 tribes, to come out from among them, and it calls all the nations to bow the knee to Christ. The beast and the false prophet will prevent the nations, or at least the vast majority of the nations, bowing before Christ. This is the time, of course, when the 10 toes give their power unto the beast for 1 hour. Just like all the people in Pharaoh gave in Egypt gave their power unto Pharaoh. The Egyptians did not oppose the work of or the decisions of Pharaoh. However, while the nations refuse to accept Christ, the 10 tribes will hearken and accept the invitation. We know of the work of Elijah when he visited Horeb subsequent to the destruction of the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, where he had to learn an element of the truth that perhaps he had not fully realized at that point, that the truth of the gospel in this dispensation is preached as a still small voice. However, at Christ's second appearing, when Elijah comes to complete his work, the Aeonian gospel will bring an end to the day of small things. It sounds through every nation, kindred, tongue and people, and will result in a great and strong wind that will rend the mountains of flesh, and the earthquake that will shake the foundations of man. This is the Aeonian gospel, and it will be received by the 10 tribes. It will no doubt be aided by the persecution of the of Israel that will have risen to heights probably only known in Hitler's Germany prior to this. As we know, the Jews have ever been reluctant to leave their wealth and persecution until persecution presents itself. And as we consider the 10 plagues that came upon Egypt 430 years after the confirmation of the covenant to Abraham, they were miracles which humbled the power of Egypt to the point where Israel were thrust out from Egypt. However, it was orchestrated from the rod of Moses. When Israel depart from the great city figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, they will have to fight their way out. Elijah will not cast his rod over waters, fields, or whatever, as did Moses. The 10 tribes will have to fight their way out. And in this particular, the Exodus under Elijah will be unlike that of Moses. Isaiah 52 gives us the the support for this. Isaiah chapter 52, verse 7. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth. The watchman shall lift up the voice, with the voice together shall they sing, for they shall see eye to eye, when Yahweh shall bring again Zion. Bring forth into joy, sing together, ye waste places of Jerusalem, for Yahweh hath comforted his people, he hath redeemed Jerusalem. Yahweh hath made bare his holy arm in the eyes of the nations, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our Elohim. Depart ye, this is the 10 tribes now, depart ye, go ye out from thence, touch no unclean thing, go ye out of the midst of her, be ye clean, that bear the vessels of Yahweh. For ye shall not go out with haste, nor by flight, for Yahweh will go before you, and the Elohim of Israel will be your reward. This gives us a clue then to the way that the 10 tribes will depart from the nations. They will have to fight their way out. They will not fight unsuccessfully, of course, for Yahweh will go before them and be their reward. And so these messengers of the third part, with Elijah at their head, are not merely preachers of the everlasting gospel, but endued with power to gather Israel together in the face of all the opposition that can be organized by the powers that be to prevent it. I have a slide which gives us some comparisons of the Exodus under Moses and the Exodus under Elijah. And there are references for them all, and there are some that they are interesting to consider. At this stage, maybe it might be worth trying to make some sense of the chronology. And I don't know if I'd be entirely successful in doing this, but We know that the Armageddon is the opening scene for this period of judgment. We've already considered the resurrection of the saints. The Gorgian host has been smashed as a result of the conflicts at and confrontations at Bosra and Jerusalem. And of course, as we know, they will fall back to the north of Israel, where they would be utterly consumed. And so the Russian power is effectively broken, in fact completely broken, by Christ and the 144,000 glorified ones. It is at this point that it is probable that Elijah and the refined third sent out to the nations to proclaim the Aeonian gospel. So it's almost immediately after the image is smitten. We all refer to Armageddon as this lightning war, and a lightning war it will be. And so it's very early on in this 40-year period, and we believe it's probably right at the commencement. As soon as Israel is delivered, they will recognize Christ, as Brother Philip referred to Psalm 24 earlier on, and certain men of them will be sent out with Elijah to proclaim the Aeonian gospel. It will commence this 10-year sultry period. It will give the nations of the world to choose whether they are a sheep nation or whether they are a goat nation. We know that countries like Britain, the countries where the English, the Bible has been proclaimed, will probably be the sheep nations. And we know full well that the goat nations will be the Europeans, regathered under the banner of the cross, giving power unto the false prophet, no doubt spurred on by the Pope's audacious claim that this is Antichrist. This victorious power is exactly what we've been expecting. This is Antichrist. Let's begin the Crusades again. Let's begin the Dark Ages again. At this time, the Pope will indeed be able to say, I sit a queen and I'm no widow. During this 10 years, I'd like to suggest that, and the succeeding 30 years as well, resulting in the complete 40 years, obviously we know why it's 40 years, and we'll come to that in a little bit. We have possibly a pincer movement. Let's have a look at Zechariah chapter 9. It might not be a pincer movement. I'm suggesting this. Of course, even in natural battles, there's more than one way to defeat an enemy. But if we read in Zechariah chapter 9 verse 12 to 16, turn you to the stronghold, you prisoners of hope. Even today do I declare that I will render double unto thee. When I have bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece, and made thee as the sword of a mighty man. Brother Matthew and Brother Philip referred to the mountains of brass earlier on, and here we have that Greek element again. This is the levelling of these mountains of brass. And here we have our 10 tribes involved in this, because we have Judah, the bow bent for him, bent Judah for me, and filled the bow with the darts of Ephraim. And so we have the complete 12 tribes involved in the work of the subduing of the mountains of brass. Yahweh shall be seen over them, and his arrow shall go forth as the lightning. And Adonai Yahweh shall blow the trumpet, and shall go with whirlwinds out of the south. Yahweh Tzevaiah shall defend them, and they shall devour, and subdue with sling stones. And they shall drink, and make a noise, as through wine. And they shall be filled like bowls, and as the corners of the altar. And Yahweh their Elohim shall save them in that day, as the flock of his people. For they shall be as the stones of a crown, lifted up as an ensign upon his land. So perhaps then we have these under the leadership, and indeed invincible leadership of Christ and the saints, Judah going forth from the land, and under Elijah and other saints, and the third of, men of the third of Judah with him, you have the 10 tribes fighting their way back. And perhaps in this element, obviously 40 years is a long period of time, we have an element of two armies, or possibly two forces fighting their way from different directions, bringing an end to the kingdoms of men. So having fought their way out of the nations, stripping power and wealth from them as they go, they will proceed in the direction of the promised land. The liberty from the nations, from their enemies, will be a milestone on their journey indeed. But, we read in the words of Christ, Elijah truly shall first come and restore all things. There is much more work to do than merely to liberate them from the land of Sodom and Egypt. So even though they've been liberated from their land, the land of their enemies, the land of Shinar, the work of Elijah is not complete. It is not, brethren and sisters, to be a reenactment of the 1940s, like Judah, who, after losing millions in the concentration camps and death camps, returned to the land and established a fleshly, godly constitution. It is an extremely successful constitution, and Israel is a successful nation this day, but God is not at the center of it. This is not to be the work of Elijah, as we know. We are to see a very different scene in the latter days. Having had the everlasting gospel made known to them, they will believe it. And as did Israel under Moses, they will confess with their mouths the sovereignty of Jesus as their Lord and Christ. And through an act, whatever that might be, enter the covenant. We remember the sprinkling of the book and the sprinkling of the people in the days of Moses. It might be an exact repetition of that, we know not. But whatever, they will accept and enter into the covenant. And in Psalm 110, Yahweh shall send the rod of thy strength out of Zion. Rule thou in the midst of thine enemies. Thy people shall be willing in the day of thy power. So they shall be willing. Positive signs indeed. And mystery of the covenant, Brother Thomas says, this wonderful deliverance from the power of the strong nations which occupy the great city spiritually called Sodom and Egypt, and the congregating of them safely in the people's wilderness, will superinduce a willingness on the part of Israel to enter into covenant with their deliverer. What is it with flesh? There's always a but, isn't there? Ezekiel chapter 20. Ezekiel chapter 20 and verse 34. And I will bring you out from among the people, and will gather you out of the countries wherein ye are scattered, with a mighty hand, and with a stretched out arm, and with fury poured out. And I will bring you into the wilderness of the people. This is the first reference we've really made to the wilderness of the people. And there will I plead with you face to face. Like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt, so will I plead with you, saith Adonai Yahweh. And I will cause you to pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. So they have been eager, having been delivered from persecution. They've been successful in fighting their way out of the nations, or although the nations tried to prevent it, they've been successful. They've been called upon to enter into this covenant, and they have accepted it. But we know, so did the nation under Moses accept it. And verse 38, I will purge out from among you the rebels, and them that transgress against me. I will bring them forth out of the country where they sojourn, and they shall not enter into the land of Israel. And ye shall know that I am Yahweh. It is a sad fact that even in the descendants, the natural descendants of Abraham, there was an excess of rebels that needed to be purged out. They needed to be purged out under Moses, and they will need to be purged out again under Elijah. Micah 7 verse 15, according to the days of thy coming out of the land of Egypt, will I show unto him marvellous things. 40, brothers and sisters, as we know, is the numerical symbol of probation. It is a number that is often associated with the length of probation of the saints. And Israel will be no different. 40 years will be needed to purge out the rebels and to purge them and bring them through the fire. So though their final destination then would be the Holy Land, they are even then not ready or prepared for entrance into the land as yet. Elijah has to bring them under the rod, this verse 37, and bring them under the rod. They have to endure a period of probation, just like Israel who entered the land under Joshua. They cannot enter directly into the land. In their state of unbelief, they are of uncircumcised hearts, as it were. and ready for the meeting Messiah. Moses brought Israel out of Egypt and into the wilderness of Sin, where they spent 40 years, that God could try them under the rod of Moses. Deuteronomy 8 tells us, "And thou shalt remember all the way which Yahweh thy Elohim led thee these 40 years in the wilderness to humble thee and to prove thee," or improve thee perhaps, "to know what is in thine heart, whether thou wouldest keep his commandments or no." What was the result of this proving process? Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians, "With many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Likewise under Elijah, they will pass through the refiner's fire in the wilderness of the peoples, where the dross is purged out. And they will be, as we read earlier on, the living sacrifice unto Yahweh." And perhaps, as a side, we can see a modern day counterpart to the departure of Lot from Sodom. Lot was prepared to leave, and Lot retained his integrity unto the end. But they were rebels amongst his company, and they were destroyed. Lot obviously being the type of natural Israel, Abraham being the type of spiritual. So we have to ask the question then, where is this wilderness of the peoples? Now we have, I've certainly sort of questioned in my mind for several years, where is this wilderness of the peoples? The answer that came naturally to my mind is that it is Europe. Why Europe, I have no idea, but whether it was because the peoples were in there or not, I don't know, but Europe is the great city figuratively called Sodom in Egypt. And as Israel are brought out from Egypt into the wilderness of the peoples can't be Europe. We looked at Mystery of the Covenant earlier on. That same quote, he says, "This wonderful deliverance from the great city, spiritually called Sodom in Egypt, and the congregating of them safely in the people's wilderness." So Brother Thomas obviously differentiated between the great city spiritually called Sodom in Egypt, which is the land of Catholic Europe, and the people's wilderness. So therefore it can't be Europe. Which still leaves us asking, where is it? Let's have a look at Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 11, or verse 10. "And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people which shall be left from Assyria, and from Egypt, and from Pathros, and from Cush, and from Elam, and from Shinar, and from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. And he shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." So I think then, we have something like that presented to us. Sodom and Egypt being in Europe. The Euphrates, as we know, runs from Turkey down to the Persian Gulf. And we all know where the Red Sea is. So it would appear that the tribes march from the south towards the Red Sea, and from the north, the west and east, to the Euphrates flood. And Brother Thomas says, "Having to congregate from such opposite directions, they will no doubt move towards the wilderness in armies, fighting their way through the countries and coalescing as occasion may serve until they arrive at their destination." Brother Thomas never says in as many words where this is, but I believe we can only come to one conclusion on this, and I certainly welcome any challenges, intelligent challenges, later on to this. But I believe that it's likely to be somewhere in the area of Jordan, Moab and Ammon, and maybe we can look at a couple of reasons for this later. And this is what I believe Brother Thomas is saying. They will have congregated in these areas, in the area of the flood of the Euphrates and the Red Sea, and they will go from north to south, and those who come from the south will move north into that area and will congregate in that area, which we believe to be, I believe to be, the wilderness of the peoples. How did Brother Thomas come to this conclusion, even if I have that area slightly wrong. I believe that the wilderness of the people has to be in that area somewhere. It's not in Europe, it's not in Africa, it has to be in the Middle East somewhere. He came to the conclusion by looking at Isaiah chapter 27, which we'll also look at. I'm going to read Brother Thomas' translation. And it shall come to pass in that day, verse 12 and 13, it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall make a gathering of his fruit from the flood of the river to the stream of Egypt. And ye shall be gleaned up one by one, O ye sons of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day, the great trumpet, the proclamation spoken of before, shall be blown. And those shall come who are perishing in the land of Assyria, and who are dispersed in the land of Egypt, and shall worship Yahweh on the holy mount at Jerusalem. Let's have a look at Isaiah chapter 43 as well. Isaiah 43. Verse 18. Remember ye not the former things, neither consider the things of old. Behold, I do a new thing. Now it shall spring forth. Shall ye not know it? I will even make a way in the wilderness, and rivers in the desert. The beast of the field shall honour me, the dragons and the owls, because I give waters in the wilderness, and rivers in the desert, to give drink to my people, my chosen. Now Brother Philip pointed out how this would be possible. Under Elijah, they will have fought their way out of the land of Shinar. Those no doubt will make their way from the north, east and the west of the land, marching towards Euphrates, probably across land. Because at this time the northern mountain of Brass will have become levelled to a plain. Those from the south or further afield will no doubt be transported with the servitude of the British Merchant Navy, wherever necessary, and will make their way to Egypt. The hostile enemy will no longer be in control of Egypt at this point, obviously. The southern mountain of Brass also being made a plain. And from the south then, they will proceed across the Red Sea, which will, as Brother Philip pointed out earlier on, have been made fordable by this time. It's also interesting, in your own time, have a look at 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 8, because we read there that Solomon made a great feast, and the whole land kept it from the flood unto the river of Egypt. So this whole area of the land, under the antitypical Solomon, the king of peace, Judah celebrating the feast under Christ, the whole area of that land will be subdued and will be made to blossom as the rose, if you like. And the ten tribes will pass through that area. Until, however, these rebels, which we spoke of, have been purged out, and hearts of flesh given to them, and the laws of Yahweh inscribed upon those hearts, they are not ready for union with Judah, who, at this stage, are as the little stone kingdom, already strengthening and enlarging itself under Messiah in the Holy Land. This is a fact demonstrated by Ezekiel chapter 11, if we can turn there, please. Ezekiel chapter 11. Verse 14. Again the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, thy brethren, even thy brethren, the men of thy kindred, and all the house of Israel holy, are they unto whom the inhabitants of Jerusalem have said, Get you far from Yahweh unto us, in this land given in possession. Therefore say, Thus saith Adonai Yahweh, Although I have cast them far off from among the heathen, and although I have scattered them among the countries, yet will I be to them as a little sanctuary in the countries where they shall come. Therefore say, Thus saith Adonai Yahweh, I will even gather you from the people, and assemble you out of the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you the land of Egypt. And they shall come thither, and they shall take away all the detestable things thereof, and all the abominations thereof from thence. And I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within you. And I will take the stony heart out from their flesh, and will give them a heart of flesh, that they may walk in my statutes, and keep mine ordinances, and do them. And they shall be my people, and I will be their Elohim. So this heart of stone has to be replaced with this heart of flesh. The laws inscribed upon them, as it was in the days of Moses and Joshua before they can enter into the land. A nation of born rebels cannot inherit the promises. And we have a similar ordinal relation as experienced in Sinai and the Moses, but with, if you like, a different orientation. In Exodus chapter 24, we read, "Then went up Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, into the Mount," this is, "and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the Elohim of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and as it were, the body of heaven in his clearness. And upon the nobles of the children of Israel he laid not his hand. Also they saw Elohim, and did eat and drink." So, in the days of Moses, it was only Moses, Aaron, and the 70 elders permitted to see the glory of Yahweh. The people of Israel were not afforded this close acquaintance, as perhaps that slide can represent. In the days of Moses, the holy place, as we might term it, and the most holy place, was presented on the mountainside, because we know that even Aaron and the 70 elders of Israel were not permitted to ascend any higher. Moses only saw the back parts of Yahweh. So we have the most holy place near the top of the mountain, near that cleft of the rock which we read of. We have the holy place where Moses, Aaron and the 70 were permitted to go. And then we have the court of Israel on the desert floor. This, if you like, is a perpendicular arrangement, and it will be exchanged for a horizontal one, because instead of on the top of Mount Sinai, the most holy place will be in Zion, Yahweh's chiefest joy, beautified and possessed of Messiah, and where exist the four cherubim, the 144,000, the four living ones. At this point, the 10 tribes are not permitted to see this glory. They are yet in the court of Israel, the rebels having to be purged out from among them, while Judah, already refined, rules with God, using the words of Hosea 11, "and with the holy ones is true." Their tents have been saved first, as we are well aware, and they dwell in the holy place being the land. This links us, brothers and sisters, with some interesting words in Isaiah chapter 54 and verse 11. Isaiah 54 verse 11, "O thou afflicted, tossed with tempest and not comforted, behold, I will lay thy stones with fair colours, and lay thy foundations with sapphires. And I will take thy windows of agate, and thy gates of carbuncles, and all thy borders of pleasant stones, and all thy children shall be taught of Yahweh, and great shall be the peace of thy children." This is the state of the things in the land where the 10 tribes are passing under the rod. The sapphire apparently is the next most precious stone to the diamond, and is a beautiful azure blue in colour. The Song of Solomon, chapter 5, we read, "My beloved is white and ruddy, his hands are as gold rings set with a beryl, his belly is as bright ivory overlaid with sapphires." And in Daniel chapter 12, "They that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, the sapphire blue, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever." This then is the glory of Zion, when this once humbled and afflicted, but now immortalized and glorified multitude of saints dwells amongst her. The tribes under Elijah are not yet permitted to see this glory, as they were not in the wilderness under Moses. Afterwards, we know that the middle wall of partition is broken down between Jew and Gentile, nationally, as it was spiritually, when Jew and Gentile became one in Christ, as heirs of the kingdom to be established. And this is an important point, because we have looked at the Mosaic order to help us understand the situation with Israel, the 10 tribes and the 2 tribes in the latter days. And we can also see a type of the ordinal relations in the kingdom itself, because Moses, who was this man whom Yahweh spoke face to face, as a man speaketh unto his friend, is obviously a type of Christ, priest and prophet, the prince of Ezekiel chapter 45. The priests, these are the sons of Zadok, who perform the rulership and priestly duties. They are the saints, the immortal priests, who have no restrictions regarding temple worship and duties. The Levites, however, these, going through Ezekiel chapter 44, we read, "The Levites that are gone away far from me when Israel went astray, which went astray away from me after their idols, they shall even bear their iniquity, yet they shall be ministers in the sanctuary, having charge of the gates of the house and ministering to the house. So we have Moses being the type of Christ, the priests being the type of the sons of Zadok, and the Levites being the type of the natural order of Levites in the kingdom age. And the people, well, these, I suppose, can be the Jews and the Gentiles after the middle wall of partition is broken down. So approaching the end then of Elijah's magnificent work, the 40 years draws to a close. He leads them to the borders of the promised land. Elijah truly shall first come and restore all things. He has restored their nation. He has given them liberty. And furthermore, he has restored true worship in them. Let us turn to our introductory reading of Hosea chapter 1. Hosea 1 verse 6. And she, Hosea's wife, conceived again and bare a daughter. And Elohim said unto him, call her name Lo Ruhamah, or No Mercy. For I will have no more mercy upon the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and will save them by Yahweh their Elohim, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen. And when she had weaned Lo Ruhamah, she conceived and bare a son. Then said Elohim, call his name Lo Ammi, or Not My People, and I will be your Elohim. This is the current state of things, is it not? We have the Jews, indeed Judah, and the 10 tribes at the moment, little differing from the nations of the world. But, verse 10, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living ale. Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together, and appoint themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. The weight of these words, brethren and sisters, these words have not even had an incipient fulfillment since the days of Solomon, when the kingdom was rent from him. In fact, his son, when the 10 tribes became independent from them. In our process of remarks then, we have established that the people will be allured into the wilderness of the peoples, doubtless by the inducement set before them in the Aeonian Gospel, the miraculous wonder working of Elijah and the men from the third of Judah. They will return to the vineyards from the wilderness, not direct from the country of their enemy. The ships will not bring them, as the Exodus brought the Jews after the Second World War, into ports like Joppa or Haifa. They will come through the wilderness of the people, which, as I have said, I believe to be the area somewhat Moab, Ammon, and perhaps Edom. And they will enter the land of Israel west of Jordan at the same point as their ancestors did under Joshua, as Brother Philip alluded to at chapter 2 and verse 14 of Hosea. Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her. And I will give her her vineyards from thence, and the valley of Achor for a door of hope. And she shall sing there, as in the days of her youth, and as in the days when she came up out of the land of Egypt. And it shall be at that time, say, that day, saith Yahweh, that thou shalt call me Ishi, and shall call me no more Baalai. Inferring that they will be a much closer relationship because they will be faithful. For I will take away the names of Balaam out of her mouth, and they shall no more be remembered by their name. And in that day will I make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, and with the fowls of heaven, and with the creeping things of the ground, and I will break the bow and the sword, and the battle out of the earth, and will make them to lie down safely. And I will betroth thee unto me for ever. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness, and in judgment, and in loving kindness, and in mercies. And I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know Yahweh. And it shall come to pass in that day, I will hear, saith Yahweh, I will hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth. And the earth shall hear the corn, and the wine, and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel. And I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them which were not my people, thou art my people. And they shall say, thou art my Elohim. Thus this valley of Achor, historically a place where Yahweh troubled Israel because of disobedience, shall instead become a door of hope, Petach Tikva. It is interesting to note also that Brother Thomas applies Isaiah 35 to this time. The desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. He seems to suggest that the desert shall blossom partly for the initial purpose of the 10 tribes in this area. And after all, as Brother Philip pointed out, this part of this area that we are dealing with is the first area that the saints conquer. They go forth to afflict the tents of Kushan. And this is the eastern portion of the land covenanted to Abraham. So perhaps it serves two purposes, this desert blossoming as the rose. It sustains the 10 tribes, and it prepares this desert area to be as the Garden of Eden again. Let's turn to Ezekiel chapter 36. Ezekiel 36, verse 24. For I will take you from among the heathen and gather you out of all countries, and they will bring you into your own land. Then will I sprinkle clean water upon you, and you shall be clean. From all your filthiness and from all your idols will I cleanse you. A new heart also will I give you, and a new spirit will I put within you. And I will take away the stony heart out of your flesh, and I will give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit within you, and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you shall keep my judgments and do them. So they will be faithful, and you shall dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers, and you shall be my people, and I will be your Elohim. I will also save you from all your uncleanness, and I will call for the corn, and will increase it, and lay no famine upon you. And I will multiply the fruit of the tree, and the increase of the field, that you shall receive no more reproach of famine among the heathen. Thus brings a close to the work of Elijah, a work which was begun some 3,000 years ago. He was taken away before he could finish. Resurrected, he will return to the 10 tribes to complete his vigorous efforts to rejuvenate the faith of the people. Have we read of many characters with such zeal as Elijah? This zeal will be put to good work in the second advent of Christ. They will be delivered from the land of Shinar, the land of their enemies. And we've alluded to the time of Moses as a type of the latter day of Exodus. But with this one significant difference, they will not relapse back into idolatry as they did after Joshua and the elders that outlived Joshua died. Isaiah 11 verse 13, Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim. Let's close by looking at Isaiah chapter 65. Isaiah 65 and verse 17. For behold, I create a new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come into mind. But be ye glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing and her people a joy. And I will rejoice in Jerusalem and joy in my people, and the voice of weeping shall no more be heard in her, nor the voice of crying. There shall be no more thence an infant of days, nor an old man that hath not filled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner being 100 years old shall be accursed. And they shall build houses and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. They shall not build and another inhabit, they shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree are the days of my people, and mine elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labour in vain, nor bring forth for trouble, for they are the seed of the blessed of Yahweh, and their offspring with them. And it shall come to pass, that before they call I will answer, and while they are yet speaking I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together, and the lion shall eat straw like the bullock, and thus shall be the serpent's meat. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, saith Yahweh. Brother Thomas says in Mystery of the Covenant, for 1,000 years its prosperity will know no interruption, but when these shall have elapsed, the nations outlying the borders of their glorious land, deceived by satanic lust of rule, will seek the dethronement of their king. The effort will be brief and unavailing, as a summer's cloud, or the morning dew shall they vanish and be no more. Yahweh's thunderbolts, the artillery of their immortal prince, will crush the rebels, and stretch out their serpent coils motionless, powerless, lifeless in the dust forever. Every curse shall cease, and death shall be no more. All that survived the crisis emerged into the Israel of God, which, not only nationally immortal and individually righteous, attains to deathlessness from the greatest to the least, and not only inherits the land, but the renovated earth forever.